Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Sean Dillon from the MS Society. He'll be telling us about recent happenings with the organization. This is a post-dated interview, folks, so some of the events referred to may already have passed. So tell me a little bit about recent happenings with the MS Society.
Certainly. Just last week, actually, we hosted a national event with our partner A&W, our sixth annual Cruising to End MS. And it was held in all of the A&W restaurants across Canada, over 800 stores. And it was an opportunity, really, to spread awareness of MS and also raise money to help support persons with MS and also to fund research to find a cure.
So, how does MS as a condition typically affect a person?
Certainly. There are a number of ways that that a person could be affected, but one of the most common symptoms really is extreme fatigue. It can also lead to issues with mobility and general well-being. It is a disease that affects the central nervous system, and it is actually one of the most common neurological disease in Canada.
So, what was the inspiration behind the Cruisin' for MS?
Well, our corporate partner, A&W, really has done a great job of helping us educate the public about MS, how to support persons with MS, and also to help us fundraise to support those persons and to find a cure. This campaign's been going for over 6 years now, and it's raising $1.5 million annually across the country. And those dollars are reinvested back in local communities, supporting persons with MS, and also supporting research.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the day-to-day work of the Society, how they support those with MS?
Certainly. The MS Society has a dual mission. First, to support persons with MS to enhance their quality of life, and second, to fund research to find a cure for MS. So local chapters across the country run programs and services. Support groups, we fund equipment to aid people in living with MS, and we also fund services such as house cleaning, yard maintenance, those sorts of things. We offer counseling and support groups, really we're there to provide information and referral to our clients to help them access not only the services they need, but the information they need to make medical decisions for themselves.
So, do you work in partnership with any other organizations to this end?
Certainly. There's a number of partnerships, both in the not-for-profit sector and also in local communities. We work in concert a lot of times with March of Dimes, social and service clubs to support equipment purchases. Certainly, we recognize the value of coming together and working together to serve persons with MS in our community.
So, in your time with the Society, what sorts of challenges have you seen?
Well, certainly the economy and the fundraising environment remains a challenge. We always want to ensure that we have the funds and resources necessary to provide support to our clients. Cost of equipment continues to increase year over year, and the number of funding sources for that equipment seems to decline or become more restricted. So we are challenged each year to certainly generate enough funds to support all of our clients and to ensure that that we're meeting the needs of everyone in our community.
So to look at the converse side of things, your time with the society, is there any one success moment that stands out for you?
Well, I think certainly when, you know, on an individual level, when you speak to a client who's really able to tell you how the society has made a difference in their lives. Personally, there was one client I advocated on behalf of with a municipal government, and it was something as simple as getting curbs cut in her neighborhood to ensure that, you know, when she was well enough to get out walking, that really she had full accessibility and didn't have to worry about tripping over the curbs and was able to walk around her neighborhood. So hearing, you know, getting the municipality to do that in that area and hearing from the client the impact that had on her day-to-day life was something that has really registered with me and has really sat with me.
So are there any further projects on the horizon for the society, like the cruise and MS?
Certainly. We've got a number of avenues in which we raise funds and provide education. We do probably the largest fundraiser that you'd be familiar with would be the MS Mandarin Walk, which occurs in May of every year, where our clients, their family, and the community really comes together to, you know, not only raise funds, but to spend a day together in fellowship. We also have a number of bike tours that run across the province and across the country that raise funds for MS. And right now, as a matter of fact, we have our Friends and Family campaign ongoing. And that's really where people go out to their local community and solicit funds on behalf of the MS Society and do that in their local neighborhoods and amongst their families.
So if you could send any one message about the work of the MS Society, what might it be?
Well, I think generally that, you know, people with MS, provided the proper support, can really lead an active life and a really engaging life. But those supports do need to be there, not only at the local level and the supports that the MS Society provides, but there's a number of actions that government can take to better support persons with MS as well as their families. You know, things like income support. Certainly with extreme fatigue being one of the key symptoms of MS, the ability to engage and disengage from work environments and still have financial support to do that is really, really important. And it's one area that we've been lobbying the federal government to take a look at. There are other areas. You know, one of the most recent ones was the smart meters and the impact that has on persons that, you know, generally are consuming a lot of electricity during the day, whether it be to aid with their mobility devices or to ensure that their home environment is comfortable while they're there, and the financial impact that has on our clients. So, you know, certainly speaking with your MP or your MPP about additional supports for persons with MS is something that everyone could do to support persons with MS in our community.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thanks.
You know, folks, there's nothing quite like it when group of people come together to try to make things better for those with a disability, or any condition, really. Fact is, one person on their own might have some of the tools, some of the steps necessary to make things better. However, you start pooling resources, pooling ideas, you can accomplish great things. Just seeing everyone united in a common cause. Just to stand by their fellow human beings and say, I want you to succeed. I want you to explore your full potential. It's truly an amazing thing. These events are friendly to the public. They're done in such a way that people can say, yeah, this sounds like something enjoyable. This sounds like something I want to get in on. That's a great icebreaker. But realizing what it really means, what the cause is really about, does often happen when somebody goes to one of these events, just out of curiosity or just to socialize. But it's the first step. It's moving forward and saying, gee, if all these people care about this cause, if all these people want individuals with disabilities to succeed, maybe there is something to it. Maybe that's something I want to be a part of. That really is how progress starts to form. It may take weeks, months, or years, but never underestimate the steps that are being taken. Never say there's no progress being made. For everyone who has their eyes opened, every person who stops to hold the door for someone in a wheelchair, just because they recognize their right to access, for everyone who just stands beside a person with a disability, never underestimate the impact that that can have on both of them. For the person with the disability can say, someone cared enough to respect my right to access, or my right to work, my right to education. For the person taking the action, it's a very enlightening experience, because for the very first time, their mind can be opened to the fact that others are capable just in different ways. The disability's credo, I can do anything you can, it's just a question of how, reigns forever true, my friends. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women, 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know." Only question now is, what will you do? Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Sean Dillon from the MS Society. And that was a post-dated interview, folks, so some of the events they referred to may already have passed. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Sharon Gretz, founder of the Childhood Apraxia of Speech Foundation. So tell me a little bit about the Apraxia of Speech Foundation.
Well, we're called the Childhood Apraxia of Speech Association of North America, and we're the only large nonprofit organization that focuses exclusively on children who have this very complex and severe speech problem called apraxia. So we're about 14 years old now, and I am the founder of the organization, and it was started when I noticed that there was no information back then when my own son was diagnosed. For families and professionals also did not really know too much about it, and so there wasn't much information on how to properly treat it either. So I started the organization with the support of some other families, and here we are today.
So, can you tell me a little bit about how apraxia affects a child?
Well, the biggest thing that you're going to notice is that the child has very limited or unclear speech. Sometimes the children appear not to speak at all. They might just make sounds. And this is, you know, about the same time where other children are rapidly progressing with their speech and language skills. But our kids sort of remain stuck and unable to move forward. So that's, you know, the first thing that you're going to notice about the child. And that there's a real interest and intent to communicate. The children, many of them understand language quite well and know what they want to say, but they just can't get the message from their brain down through the neural pathways to make their mouth move and their tongue and lips and all the coordinated action that's needed so that it just isn't happening for them at the right time, at the right speed, with the right force, and in the right order of all these sounds and sequences of sounds. So their speech is highly unintelligible or sometimes very limited.
So are there any possible treatments available?
Well, we do know of one treatment that is successful for children with apraxia speech, and that is speech therapy. And most often what's recommended, depending on the severity of the apraxia, because really there can be a range from mild to severe or profoundly affected. But when children are at least moderately to severely affected and really struggling and not being understood, speech therapy is the key, and enough of it. So for these particular children, they need more therapy than do kids with other types of speech issues. And they need it to be intensive, meaning that the time that they're with their therapist and even in home practice, people are working with them on repeating words over and over and over with support and with help and what we call cueing for the right placement of their articulators, their lips, tongue, jaw, palate, so forth. So that's the only really known effective treatment at this time.
So in your time working with apraxia, what sorts of challenges have you seen?
Could you repeat that question? I'm not sure.
In your time with the foundation, what sorts of challenges have you seen as far as work with apraxia?
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, there's many, many challenges that the kids face as well as the family. The children, for instance, they need to be able to communicate, you know, and so if a child doesn't have a means of effective communication, then a number of things can happen, sort of a ripple effect. One is that they may grow frustrated and develop behavioral-type outbursts because they're just so frustrated. Some kids do the opposite. They just sort of withdraw and give up, and that's really sad to see that happen in a young child who, you know, most likely has the potential to learn to speak if they had the appropriate therapy and so forth. So we see that type of thing, and then as the children get into school age, one of the ramifications of early difficulties like this is a high propensity to have literacy-related problems. So most of the kids will have some degree or another of, and when I say most, I mean, you know, 50% or more, have some degree or another of reading, spelling, written expression type issues at school, all related back to the speech problem. So these are some of the challenges, as well as just, you know, the social impact of a child not being able to engage in conversational back and forth and playing with language like the kids do. And so they, you know, their experience is really impoverished. They don't have that background that so many, you know, all the other children have, so that when they are able to speak more clearly, hopefully, they're just not as experienced socially, and so that can impact them with relationships at school and with peers and so forth. So in addition to that, the families, they have many struggles as well, because once the families realize that, in fact, this is a pretty serious speech problem and not what we would call a simple speech delay that's going to go away on its own, they're faced with the impact of needing to provide or arrange for speech therapy for their child. And often what we see is that, national systems in the education world, for example, may not provide the kind of intensity that the child needs, or through, provincial programs or state programs. And so then we're looking at private insurance, and that can get costly because many insurance plans do not cover it, the speech therapy. And so we see many parents struggling to pay out of pocket, make sure that their child gets that best shot, their very best shot at developing speech, language, and communication. And so it's a heavy burden financially for families, as well as in terms of the time commitment. And then, finally we see that, in terms of a systems level, people, are still learning about apraxia. It's a somewhat rare condition, but insurance companies, for example, aren't consistent in their ability or policies to fund speech therapy for these children. We've been pushing and actually funding through our organization treatment research so that more information is published that will help down the road to hopefully get some systems help with treatment. And research as a whole has been very limited with apraxia, but has been increasing lately, and we feel that our advocacy has had a lot to do with that, as well as our funding of pilot treatment research projects.
So, in your time with the association, is there any one success moment that stands out for you?
Oh my gosh, we experience success moments all the time, and really when it comes down to it, for us, the success is when we hear back from families about how our help really aided them in getting a child what they needed, and how successful the children can really be. It really is inspirational and heartwarming that with the right help, so many of these kids just go on to do really great things in life and to pursue their dreams and interests and talents and be full participating, youth and citizens, and that's really what's meaningful. That's very meaningful to us.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
That's always the trouble, folks, especially with the rare conditions. Getting the word out, making sure that you find the right help, the right support. Somebody tells you there's nothing out there, it's just a fluke, then that's the wrong answer, generally speaking. You need to keep asking questions, asserting your rights, taking the steps you need to take to improve quality of life. No one can speak better to what their own needs are than they themselves, which is why things like having individuals with disabilities serving on accessibility advisory committees, it's absolutely necessary, in my opinion. Just to make sure that there's real representation, that you're not just working from a statistical model on how things could affect a person. Fact is, it does vary with the strength of the individual. If they have the drive and the motivation to succeed, they'll find a way. Having people standing beside them to help them reach their best, something we all need, whether we have a disability or not. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the number 4, at gmail.com. Always love to hear from you folks at home. Really is when we start to ask questions about disability life that we grow as a society. We start to realize that there are reasons behind the way a person might make use of a mobility device or the way they might interact with others in a workplace, academically, just out in the community. It's all a matter of keeping an open mind, saying to yourself, can this be done? Can I, as a member of society, contribute to finding a way to make things better? The task may look impossible. It may seem daunting. And the truth is, if it's just one person out there trying to make a difference, yes, it would be daunting, and it might seem overwhelming. However, it's never just one person. It may appear that way. If you look long and hard enough, you will find others who might be affected directly, might not be, but others with an open mind, with ideals about equality and helping others reach their best. Those are the kinds of people who, when united, can really make a difference. You see it all the time. Lobby groups trying to change a policy. Disability groups that are working just to provide a forum for those affected to speak their mind. In some cases, it can be for the very first time. First time having an opportunity to say, I am a member of this community, entitled to respect, consideration, and equality. As a friend recently reminded me, things like accommodations in an academic setting or in a workplace, they're not about providing an advantage to one person over another, simply about leveling the playing field, simply about providing the right opportunities. It's the same with anyone in society, really. If given the right tools, the right opportunities, and working to one's own skills, that they achieve their best. If they find a way to make a problem or a task relatable to a skill set they do have, it becomes that much easier, because they have a basis from which to proceed. During Sharon's interview, she mentioned there was no information out there. In the beginning, that might have been very true. However, there was her experience, and the experience of others who came to work alongside her. So now, for anyone seeking information, seeking understanding about this condition, there is a foundation on which to proceed. There is information. Of course, it is, as always, important to have the right sources of information, speaking to someone knowledgeable in the field, a medical professional, or someone with real first-hand experience with a condition. Talking to someone who does understand about these things can really be an eye-opening experience, in so much as you come to realize that there are others out there, and that together you really can make a difference. But for any given condition, it's important, critically important, never to rest on our laurels, never to say, we've made the quality of life as good as we can, let's move on to something else. Fact is, as we take steps forward, it's important to monitor those steps. You put a policy in place, fine. Every now and then, check to make sure it's really working. Conduct surveys. Make observations. Take a little time to see if the work you're doing is really working. Because it's in this way that those affected with any given condition not only feel that things are being done to improve things for them, but they recognize that they're being respected and considered. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. You've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.